Okay, Mr. Mertz, where were you born? It's working fine.
All right. Well, I was born in Reading, Pennsylvania in 1904. And went to school there and graduated from Reading High School, at which time I had already been playing professionally, but actually just the last year, I was playing in a non-professional group of the high school fellows with some good musicians around there, and these are young musicians at high school at the time, and we used to just non-union, see, and we'd play at school functions, and also we used to, our biggest thing would be when we'd play out at some occasion, we maybe would get a dollar and a half a piece for the thing, and our big thing would be, do we also get eats? Did they serve refreshments? And so that was my introduction and theirs.
Did you hear any records then, like of the original Dixieland Jazz Band?
Oh, yes, and I was going to high school. Paul Whiteman just had come out there, and with that Ambassador Ballroom group, he had nine men. That's the first time he had gone east from San Francisco, and that's where they started plugging him on Victor Records. So he made his first Victor Records there. And
Wang Wang Blues and that sort
of thing. All those, yeah, I got most of those too, and I suppose you have. And Whispering, oh,
yes. Geez.
And I used to go home at lunch time. I didn't live too far from high school, and I had a phonograph right on the table. I'd play these records of Paul Whiteman, particularly Ted Lewis, and
yes.
and Art Hickman too was still going at that time. But anyhow, I was preparing myself for future. I was hoping, listening to the best recordings, and well, I played non-professionally, you might say, non-union,
right.
In the high school group. Then, in 1922, by that time I had joined the union and was playing with this Edgar Hangen. Contractor who just club dates, and
you remember what instrument did he play?
He didn't play any. Well, yes, he did, but not in the dance band. He was just a contractor, just like Meyer David was.
Okay.
Hangen owned the music store, Hangen's music store. He and his brother, but that was a great booking center, the only other important booking agency of the United States for society. This was society work.
Yes.
And then fairs and anything like that. Just like Meyer Davis set up. And the other rival was Paul Speck, who later went on to bigger things and fine orchestras. And I didn't play for Paul Speck ever until later in New York City when he was there and he was making recordings and these were transcriptions for radio that I remember the couple dates that I played for him, just as freelance.
So you were in the high school band. How did you get with the Dorsey band? You were telling.
Oh yeah, I started with
about that girl. Yes.
Yeah, this is when I was now in the professional class in 1922. I had joined the union and I was
yes.
playing. Well, they were hanging the Zeltzer and several other groups that I called just freelance work, and. The gal in that picture I showed you, who played piano, was the sister of the fiddle player there they had
what
at
was
that
her
time.
Name?
Crossan. No, she was that was her. She was a sister of Jimmy Crossan,
yes.
Who was a fiddle player and later became a damn good tenor saxophone player and played with the California Ramblers later. And she was married and she had come pregnant and she had to actually retire, and. One of the members that they used to have come up from Reading, Pennsylvania for their dates, Reading was only about 40 miles away from the Dorsey home, which was at Lansford, Pennsylvania, which is just right a couple of miles from Mahanoy City, if you know the region. And I'd go up, well, I didn't come to it. The fact is, he told them about me that I was,
Who told you?
The banjo player that lived in Reading that went with the Dorsey brothers.
Okay, what was his name?
Wait a minute, I had his name. I was going to spit it out, and I can't think of it, but it doesn't matter. He wasn't, he was just a Reading musician.
But he was with that Dorsey band, and he recommended you.
Yeah, and so I went up there, and they generally would have maybe say about three engagements a week, and if they didn't, but if they did have 3 days, then I'd generally stay at, I did always stay overnight then at the Dorsey's home. His father and mother were still there, father and mother were still alive. And however, if it would just be a one-nighter and there was nothing else in view too much, I'd go back to Reading because it didn't take more than about an hour and a half, something like that.
What type of music did you play? Do you remember playing? Well, did you play any jazz things, or did you play some?
Well, it was jazz in those days, yes. Yeah. But most of it had been just formal society things that the hanging booking agency had. But then I did, you know, play jazz, what we call jazz. That'd be funny. I wish I had a recording of the way things were.
Probably sounded like the original Memphis Five. One of the early groups or something like that.
Well, it was of that period, not sophisticated hot music as we call it hot music. And I guess there's still a lot of people still call it hot. I don't know.
How far did the Dorsey band, did they ever go out of the state when you were with them, or did they just play?
No, just the coal regions. Okay. That was a career up there. Gee. Several of the bands from Reading would go up there, and just as I did, but only as bands, Reading groups. I mean, the coal regions would, upon occasion, it had at some big holiday or some big occasion, they'd get the top bands of the country there. Paul Whiteman, Ted Lewis, and Art Hickman was going on at that time, and Earl Fuller. And first time I ever heard Earl Fuller's band, that was, you know, a big band before Whiteman.
We also had a small group, Earl Fuller's famous jazz band, that competed with the ODJB. He was a piano player, wasn't he?
Damn if I remember. I think he was. I forgot what instrument he played, but...
He did play piano. Ted Lewis started playing with him.
Oh, yes. No, I didn't know that.
So when's the first time you heard Fuller? He had a large band.
I was playing at the Hotel Berkshire, a supper session job.
Where was that? What's
at the Reading, Pennsylvania. Okay. And Harold Doran, he and I would play musical comedy things and popular songs and light classical music during a two-hour session each night at this Hotel Berkshire, which was a classy hotel for Reading and the best one there, and only one, I guess, that supported any music of that nature. And he used to augment on Sunday nights, I think it was. We'd have a more classical group, had a violinist, another violin, another, and a cello. And at one occasion, we had a great flutist who came from Reading and later went to the Toscanini Symphony in around New York, Johnny Wimmer. Gee, he was a, oh, what a beautiful flutist he was. This was before he went to the symphony.
So what about Fuller? Did you hear him then?
When I was playing at that hotel.
Yes.
Fuller was brought from New York for some big occasion in the ballroom of this hotel.
Yes.
And of course, I went there and that night after our end, it probably started about 8 o'clock or so, and I remained there. We had a little balcony there. I perched myself up there, and this is the first real big group I think I ever heard. And the funny thing about it, you know, who was a pianist with that? Dewey Bergman, who's still alive, the last I heard. Dewey Bergman, and I, did I think he was great, and he was. He was one of the leading pianists then. Well, to be playing with Earl Fuller was something. Do you know where I next saw him? When he came out with Goldkett's band, when they went to two pianos, he was a star pianist. They brought him on. He became the star pianist, and I, who was just playing the single piano they had right before, became second pianist, and he was the featured pianist. And then we'd work out to can of things to do for a little featuring. And then then we started making Victor records, and Dewey was with the band, the very first one. We made them in March 1924.
So let's go from the Dorsey Brothers. Let's. You should get to how you got from there to Detroit. You were saying about how you were at the Dorsey.
My intention had been to go to University of Pennsylvania, and in 1923 I was going to. No, 1922, late in the fall season, I had gotten my bond agreement, $300 I was supposed to deposit upon acceptance, and I was accepted to enter University of Pennsylvania. That meant I would have to live there, of course, and I did go there. And through a mutual friend again, who I'd played with and who was now going to with a new organized band. Meyer Davis, you know, that was a big center for him too, beside Boston and New York. I guess he had offices for his Meyer Davis music. And his first saxophone player, the first call man, decided to go out for himself and form a band and leave Meyer Davis, and then capitalize on his reputation they already had made. Charlie Houston, his name was. And Charlie Houston hired me, and this was just perfect because he was just going to be playing around Philadelphia season, and I could go to school, and
yes.
And this was great as far as I was concerned. And we played a few engagements around the center there, around Philadelphia. And then he got an engagement to have a 9-piece band. I don't know whether I showed you that picture of it or not. He was booked by the manager of the Hotel Addison, who had come east. He had gotten Paul Speck's band out there. It was a new hotel, and I don't know whether Speck opened, but he was. I know Arnold Johnson and Paul Speck, I think, were the only two bands that played out there before we came in. But Paul Speck had become famous over the radio. You know, Detroit was one of the first places that the radio was ever broadcast any distance.
Yes.
And in Pittsburgh, I forget the station number, but Pittsburgh and Detroit were the two. WWJ in Detroit had powerful.
So you were lines. With that band, and he decided to go to Detroit then?
He took the contract. Uh-huh. And that brings in another amusing thing. And when he did that, I was all ready to enter.
Oh, school.
School hadn't entered. It was the start in September, the engagement. And just about a couple of weeks before, the school, I was all preparing.
Yeah.
And so I was hesitant about going, and I said, gee, I'm signed up here, and I said, I want the college education is most important. Well, he gave me a few bucks more. At that time, if you made $85 a week, it was pretty good money, and I think he raised it $10 or something and induced me to come. And he said, look, I'll take care of that bond. He says, I have my brother-in-law is a member of the faculty there. He'll square that bond at $300. Well, I'll go. Oh, Jesus, so, well, nothing lost going out there. Detroit had already had a reputation, you know, big money in the auto industry there, and
yes.
That was going great guns there, and they were paying money that was superior to any place. And so I went out there with that band, and I had about a 3-month engagement. Meanwhile, while I was there, I got a notice from the university that where was that $300 bond that I owed them because I didn't show up. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote to them and told them about the case of it, and whatever it is, they forgot about it when I told them. I mentioned the guy's name and everything. He had given me a letter. He said, I'll get you a letter to the University of Detroit out there. That was a selling thing.
Uh-huh.
He said, I have this cousin of mine, or brother or in-law. And he said, so that settled it. Well, I was going to get a letter, introduction. And I did. I went out there, and I entered the University of Detroit.
Okay.
And that was September 1924. to the latter part of the season, you know, the fall term. And, well, that engagement only lasted 3 months, and then I was stuck out there. I had entered school and couldn't leave, and so I remained there, and I had deposited my card, of course, at the Detroit Union, and then just got to jobbing around, and I made a connection with a little supersession orchestra too there, and so I was going along at that time when Goldkit's band, which had only started in the summer of 1922, when the Greystone Ballroom just opened, a brand new place, was a story in itself about that Greystone Ballroom, elaborate place, big. It was
So Goldkit's band opened up, yes.
And they got permission to import people from all over the country, and he got great musicians, both from Chicago and some from New York. For the Greystone Ballroom, and but the pianist didn't work out for him. The one they had, he couldn't take any flashy chords, but I could. I used to play Kitten and the Keys and all of those things like
yes,
that.
Yes, that's conflicting.
Yeah, and I was, you know, for a young kid, after all, in 1926, I was only 18 then. I think, see, my birthday is September the 1st. I was 17 when I went out there, and then it turned over. 18 for the after practically settled there.
So how did you get with Goldkit? So he heard you?
He heard about me, and I guess he was testing other people too, interviewing. I remember Charlie Horvath, of course, you know, who was a right-hand man later,
yes.
And who was a fine drummer. He was drumming then with the Greystone Band. He was a manager of the band there. And Goldkit played the Detroit Athletic Club with a small group. That was his entry where he got into all this big thing. I don't know where he got that contact, but Goldkit was booked to Detroit originally from Chicago. He was playing in the Benson office. Benson, you guys, you've heard of it.
Yeah, Benson.
Benson,
orchestra.
Benson had the big orchestra that recorded. Had different leaders at various times. The first time I heard of him was when Roy Bargate was the leader of the band, a nice band. And then I forget the name, the guy that followed him, but you know who was playing the first time I ever heard him?
Who?
Frank Trombaugh. I was playing in that orchestra. I used to go home. No, with the Benson.
Oh yeah, he played
the
Benson
Orchestra. Right. Used to have the contract in the summertime to go in Atlantic City at the Million Dollar Pier.
Yes.
And I used to go home. My folks there were in Atlantic City during the summer seasons, and I from the Greystone Ballroom when the first vacation I got, I went back there, and then I went to the Million Dollar Pier, of course, and I heard this orchestra, and I heard Frank Trombaugh. For the first time, I noticed him. He was the first guy that ever played what you call a rhythm sax, that became very popular later. The first person of any, you know, top flight. Maybe there are other guys that I know. The guy in Detroit by the name of Freddie Morrow. In fact, when I heard
Fred Morrow recorded with Red Nichols.
Yeah, they were friends.
I
saw him. Did you?
I played those on my show. Yeah.
Did you notice the sax there?
He's good.
Oh, damn right he was, and that's a guy I'd heard. Uh-huh. Freddie, he couldn't read very much at that time, but then later he learned to read. But anyhow.
You joined Goldkit?
Well, no, but I meant, this is after I joined Goldkit, my
you
first vacation.
You went back a little bit before when you were playing with Goldkit? Where did you start playing with him?
At the Greystone Ballroom.
Do you remember who was in the band?
Well, I got the picture there, and I could. It was completely different from the band that later it changed all around.
Could I stop it and get that picture?
Yeah.
And we can. Okay, here we have a picture of the Goldkit band when you first joined. This picture was taken February 1923.
Right.
Okay, so who do we have left to right?
Left to right. Now remember, this is a. Let me explain how this came about. They had three bands when I joined. In the main ballroom, they had the feature band was Gene Goldkit. And in fact, he was a contractor for the other orchestras. This was an instrument. Geez, it's funny. I should get to some of these other things about it. The Greystone Ballroom was originally built was being built by a Chinese syndicate. There was going to be a big Chinese restaurant, but they went bankrupt, and the band was taken over by a bank. I don't know which bank it was, but the head guy who was in of this big bank in Detroit, who had been the man who was assigned changing over the thing from the Chinese restaurant policy to making it and completing it and making it a ballroom, yes. See, which were going great guns at that time. He was a member of the DAC, and that's where Gene Golkett had a supper session job, which played light classical music with four men and string instruments. Gene, who was a classical pianist, you know, he played strictly Meyer Davis type of music, and however, he was a favorite with the clientele. This, you know, that was used to supposed to be the wealthiest club in the world, the DAC. All the big auto magnates, the Detroit Athletic Club, all important big operators of industrial enterprises. You had to be a member. You wouldn't be accepted if you were just ordinary as a member, and it cost plenty to get it. But he was just thought they all liked him. He used to augment the group. Didn't augment it. He got a little dance group that used to play dance music on Wednesdays or Thursdays, I think it was, and Saturdays. They would play about 3 hours after the supper session, and with a five-piece of saxophone, drums, and violin, and banjo. And anyhow, the guy who's getting together this enterprise and getting it set, he didn't know anything about musicians or anything like that, and musical problems there, and he asked. I heard the story, you know. I mean, it's, I know it's not an exaggeration. Gene, he said, "Gosh Almighty," he says, "you know so much more about this music." He says, "Will you take care of it? We want to have two orchestras in the main ballroom, and then we're going to have a cabaret on the second floor, where we only have a five-piece jazz combination."
Right.
And Gene, of course, said, "Well, certainly, I'll take it over." And so that first band was organized, and it was the same combination as this, except there was only one piano. And before this picture, I had replaced that pianist, as I told you earlier, who didn't meet their satisfaction. And 2 weeks after I had joined the original band, they suspended the whole policy, which had been a general ballroom, and made it a nickel dance affair. And, oh, I said they had two orchestras in the main ballroom, Ted Marlin's orchestra, which was a nine-piece orchestra, and a nice little group, but this bigger group was the featured group.
The Golkett band. Okay. Yeah. Do you want to mention who's in this and what the instruments? Who's the person from left to right? Who's that?
Yeah. Well, wait a minute. I must explain this.
Oh.
They eliminated the second band, and they decided to have two pianos. So that,
oh,
and then they would divide it up. One would be in the waltz section, and the other would be the jazz section for in the relief periods.
Uh-huh.
But the band in the major was this is the whole band. That's the reason. But we didn't have any relief band now. You see, I mean,
yes.
And not only that, the hadn't been the moneymaker in that cabaret, which had a damn good jazz band there, a five-piece Dixieland type thing, but it hadn't paid off, so they closed that too, retrenched. Now we were the only attraction, the Great Stone Ballroom. You know, they never did use any other part of that whole vast building. It's amazing that they couldn't utilize it. They had, well, you saw the picture of the place, and
yes,
it had, I think, about four stories. It never, we'd go up there and rode around just to see pillars there. Nothing. They never leased it. I don't know why that one. That they must have been losing a lot of money, but for some reason I don't know.
Okay, in the band.
Now the band.
Okay, from left to right, who's this?
Now that's Charlie Hamill, violinist.
Yes.
See this? I have another picture where seated, I think, our entrance, but I don't know where it is right now.
Okay, Charlie Hamill.
Charlie Hamill, the violinist. Now, he had been there. He was there when I joined. Now, the band, this band is augmented, of course. Well, the original combination was the same, except only one piano. It had three saxophones and two trumpets and two trombones. That was the original opening band.
Okay. And next to him?
Doc Riker, was there at the very start when the place opened.
Sax, yes.
This is Sink Berenson, who played with the original Dixieland Jazz Band and really the
What's
best.
What's his name?
Sink Berenson. Berendson. I don't know how he came into the picture because...
What instrument did he play?
Trombone. One of the trombones.
When did he play with the ODJB? I've never seen his name associated. With La Rocca's group?
No, I think the other pianist that followed La Rocca. It was not the very... No, wait a minute. I have the data there of the bands he played with.
He plays trombone. Then.
Trombone, but he was...
He would have replaced Eddie Edwards then.
Yeah. I'm sure it was the original Dixieland Jazz Band, and he replaced, and he was a damn good man. He played, you know, the rough jazz type of thing in those days, and so they catered to the hot thing.
So what was his name again, the third from the left?
Sig Berenson. Berendson, I'm pretty sure it's spelled.
There's you.
That's myself, innocent looking and poor.
Okay, then, next.
Charlie Edwards.
And what instrument did he play?
First trumpet, and he was a virtuoso. Really, not a dance man, but that's a genius.
Like B.A. Rolf or something?
Right.
Yeah.
He used to be in vaudeville just like B.A. Rolf. And oh, God almighty, could he skate around? His idea of jazz would be to take a big variation thing. But he had a beautiful tone. When he came to a waltz or anything that had a beautiful melody, he could play beautifully.
Okay, that looks like it's...
That's Howdy Quicksell.
Howdy Quicksell. Banjo.
And he was... these were all there originally. See, these are... I don't know how... It was probably Charlie Horvath that managed to get a good... A good hot man like Sig there, because this was an arrangement band strictly. Oh, I used to go up there before I was even considered for that, because it was a great arrangement band. I forget the name or the arranger, a top arranger they had imported. All these guys were imported, and not Detroit people. Uh-huh. I don't know how he, old kid had that union at his finger that he could bring. You think that the members would protest from not using local men, but Gene could bring them in. The same thing happened when the Book Cadillac Hotel opened in the late 1924. Mm-hmm. Brought guys from all over the country.
There's Howdy, the tall guy in the
Howdy Quicksell happened to come in. Doc had been hired, and they needed a banjo player still, and Doc is the one. They both were from Fort Wayne, Indiana. And Doc had suggested Howdy, and so Howdy came along for the very start of the thing.
Okay,
now,
who's this tall guy?
That's Bill Krenz. He was a feature pianist. He had been with the Bensonovas in Chicago,
What's his last name?
Krenz, K-R-E-N-Z. He died about
Bill
2 years ago, at least.
Okay.
I saw him was down at the Bix Festival that... the second one they gave down Davenport.
Oh.
He
was a featured pianist.
Yeah. He wasn't a real hot man. His big feature, he played Noel fast as hell. That's kind of like Kitten in the Keys was popular then at that time. But he wasn't, you know what I mean, a hot, conceiving man. Not like
Sig. Who's this?
This is Owen Bartlett, the first saxophone player.
What was his name?
Owen Bartlett. Now he was not there until this changeover had occurred.
Okay.
He came after I was there already. I was only a single pianist there a short time before.
Did he play alto or?
Alto. Okay. Alto and baritone. And he was a fine, straight man, beautiful tone. And he left not too long after, I was with him there. He was about... with us in about 6 months, when he got an offer from New York, and he went to New York, it was an offer he couldn't refuse, I guess. Mm-hmm. And Now, by the way, he's still living and he's here in Los Angeles. The only sad thing is he had a stroke and he is kaput. I mean, he does it like a kid. I could, in fact, I'm calling him tomorrow. I'm calling, they live down south, and I want to call his wife. His wife's a, and Jesus, a hell of a thing. Jesus.
Owen.
Owen Barton, yeah.
You know what, another person.
You'll probably see his name in the union book still here.
Okay. Who's this next to him?
That's Charlie Horvath.
Charlie Horvath.
Yeah.
What did he play with the band?
Drums and
drums.
For that type of drumming in those days, he was the solidest drummer, especially for a dance hall. You couldn't wear that temple with that guy. He was a great drummer.
Okay, and the guy with the mustache?
That's his father. Oh. That's his father. See, these were both Charlie and his father.
What was his name?
Steve
Horvath?
Steve Horvath, yeah.
What did he play?
String bass.
String bass.
Now, he was a classical musician, and of course, to say this. Now, the reason they are so much aligned with the Goldkett situation is this. When Gene Goldkett was centered in Chicago and booked by the Benson office,
yes.
That's Bass Gene hadn't been to, I guess when he first came, I don't know whether he knew the father beforehand or not, but anyhow, he lived with them, see.
Yes.
And this man really was the most remarkable string bass player you ever heard. He was originally a member of a world-famous European group of six, I think it was six brothers, strings, sextet, that were renowned in Europe. I don't know whether they still stayed together or made tours in the United States, but anyhow, he had left that group years before and settled in Chicago. And actually, he was one of the guys, when I went there for an audition, Charlie and Gene, and he, because Gene had the greatest confidence in him, because he looked on him as practically a father, I guess, and Gene, I was so young, you can see there, Goldkett, and I don't know whether Charlie also, but no, I don't know how what Charlie thought, but anyhow, Gene was a little bit, maybe I was so young, and while I played Chip McGee and all those things, and my idea of jazz at that time, which is quite different than now, but I was, well, it mustn't have been too bad because that Philadelphia orchestra was picked in there in Philadelphia when I entered there and was chosen to join that new group. And now, anyhow, let me say about this. This old gent here, oh, he looked upon me, oh, I remember, I could hear him talk when they went out to judge it, or else I learned. No, I heard him. Say, he said, that boy has talent. That boy has talent. He said, he needs development. That's all that. He needs
good.
Development. But and I thought, I need development? What the hell? I'm pretty good. But he, first of all, would take a chorus and play arpeggios like a fiddle player. In fact, you know, by the way, Owen Bartlett had gone to the, his training was as a fine violinist. He had gone to the Boston Conservatory,
yeah.
And had graduated of that, and had played in the Boston Symphony too when Karl Mock was the earlier, and he knew all the Kreutzer literature, you know, violinist,
yes.
Stuff, which is tough as hell to play right. And the old gent and he used to go down in the musicians' room in the bass room, they used to play in unison these Kreutzer exercises. That's how good he was. And he would use, when he'd take this chorus, it would be in a nice tune. It wouldn't be a hot, he was not a hot bass player. He could pizzicato like hell, but I mean, it was not really
Steve
jazz.
Brown,
see.
Yeah.
And so, he's just, when the two pianos came up particularly, the bass, well, I wish they had the picture where the pianos were set up, but anyhow, he was right in back of my piano when we got the two pianos there.
Yes.
And he used to keep his eye on me. He got Paulus, Hungarian. They were Hungarian. And he'd say, Paulus,
the left end, the bass note, drums, I was his protege. All right, Ray Ludwig. Ray Ludwig, I first heard him was when I went before this band was organized, and I was playing. I know Holly Quirks and I used to go up this Monte Carlo restaurant, which is the Boulevard and Woodward Avenue. Ralph Williams' band was a Benson booked orchestra, nine pieces, and a hot band. That's what we call a hot band in those days from Chicago, the Chicago style hot, see, which isn't bad. And Ray was a trumpet player, and he used to have at that time a trick utes, what do you call the one ute? I can't think of the one that's so popular, and used to growl and everything like that on it. See, that was a fashion in those days, along with the hot playing. And he was a good legit man too.
Who's this?
Now this trombone player, he didn't last too long. He was a good capable guy.
Who's this man?
And now I'd have to, I always.
He was a trombone player?
Yeah, a trombone player. We had two trombones and two trumpets. And of course, he and Charlie were the two trumpets, and Sig and this fella. He just came in. He was not a name thing or a big name, but he actually, I think, was brought in just when the trombone player, who was a very top guy and a good arranger too, besides, had left, and they brought him in as the best available man. So he didn't last too long.
Do you remember his name?
I have it, but I can't pick it right out now. I have his name.
Well, you can give him. Who's the guy in the far right?
This was the guy. Was a banjo player, and he doubled sax a bit. See, and he played.
Didn't
good
Howdy
enough
play?
That's right. They had. I don't know why, but he was. They got Ray, Bill Krenz, and this fella. Now I can't think. I have to give you his name too, but I have it. They were from this band that was a big favorite. The first hot band I ever heard, really, of that style, the Chicago hot style. And Howdy Quicksell and I, the same thing. He had never heard a band like this. And we used to go up to this Monte Carlo after it was a nightclub, see, and we'd go up after our job at night and listen to that band. And it was going great guns. We thought it was just fine. And
so that was...
He didn't stay too long because his saxophone player wasn't of that high order. He had replaced another guy who was a good legit man and acceptable hot style, but anyhow they replaced him later in the next picture, which I would show you that he's no longer there. But this is the way it was. The next picture I have is the one where they decided after this was in the after the Greystone used to run in the summertime, and that when it first opened.
Do you want to get the next one then?
Yeah, it's been changed. Let me see if there's another picture that. Is that recording now?
Yeah.
Oh, it
I'm
is. I was just going to check my thoughts in a minute.
Sure. Yes.
The summer season, as I said, they sort of just slept that with people taking vacations.
Mm-hmm.
And I know at this time that they were already talking about in the fall, Gold Kit was going to bring top people in the best and have a sort of a big changeover in the personnel.
Yes.
And keep some of the people who we thought were really worthwhile. As I say, some of these, for various reasons, left. Now, this. I was going to university to try I told you. This is they hired for the spring, I guess it was the spring celebration there, whatever you call it. What did it say? University of Detroit. Oh, prom. The prom.
Right.
Yeah. And the
April 4th, 1923. It shows all those people standing in a circle. Yes?
Now, this is a close. I had this. I don't know whether it's a separate picture, but I. Geez, it's amazing. Whatever it is, that's the band that's right there. Now, this for the summer season, the city's vacations were in order, and just like a temporary thing, the guys some of the old there. Now, the changes here are
so that picture was taken after the first one. This one was taken after the first one you did?
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is taken for right here at the same date. This is the close-up and the archer is playing up there.
Okay.
There is Carmen Lombardo.
Gee.
Before the, see, Owen Bartlett had left and Carmen, I don't know, they hadn't organized their orchestra. They had
on the far left.
Yeah. He was playing first sax. Gene Corlett knew of him before, and Carmen, I think their band had been discontinued at this time. When I first came to Detroit, they had a small group, only about six men, playing out at a roadhouse near Mount Clemens. That's where I first met the Lombardo brothers and so forth. And but anyhow, he was around. I don't know whether Goldkett got him from Canada. They had gone back to Canada, Ontario they lived in. And Carmen filled in for 6 weeks at least there, the summer season. And this fellow, there's Doc. Doc remained, and he hadn't gone any
places. Okay, second from the last, yeah. Doc Riker.
Now this fellow was a fine saxophone player, and he doubled flute too. But he was there to see how I fitted in for the idea for the fall. But whatever it was, he didn't come in the new the later lineup, which I'll show you, because he was going to. He was only, I say, sitting there temporarily, and if they could meet her, and maybe, I don't know, maybe they didn't want to work for what their offer was, because he was good. He was damn good, and a very personal guy, too. This other fella was a hot man. I had played with him in Philadelphia with the seven Broadway entertainers when I had, that, which again, they're bringing a love story. But I mean, I better not go there.
Who's the, you skipped there.
No, this is another saxophone player, four. They had, see, they were just trying
so that's
out.
That's fourth from the right.
The only one who showed up a job there was Doc. These other were, now Owen was expected, actually Owen Bart was supposed to come back, mm-hmm. but he never did come back after the summer. He went to New York there and remained there. It was, he was a top man in New York band too. I forget the big band, the recording bands mainly. And I forget the name of the big man at that time. He was first sax for him. Now, this fellow's name was Vogel. He was from Philadelphia. And I say he was playing in this band that I, the Seven Broadway Entertainers, where I first met him. And he was damn good for that kind of jazz at that time. He didn't play like trombone or anybody, but he was the hot style at that time. And now, only Nam Trone was he couldn't read.
What was his name? Do you remember his name?
I can't remember his Vogel, but I don't remember his first name now. Okay. Just at the time, so the reading handicap, he was good, but he couldn't have played the arrangements. You see, I mean, he couldn't have learned to read. But I'll tell you about this later about reading, learning to read quite on his job. Now here's old man. What the hell is his name? Charlie Hamill was on vacation, because this is a legit violinist, the friend of Gene's that he put in playing the violin right there at this time. Now up here is old man Sayre. He was a symphony bass player too. The old gent had left or had gone home. He didn't come back. I don't think there's another picture with him on at all. Old man Sayre, as we used to call him, Sayre, that's for S-A-Y-R-E. And he was a fine, legit, he just played legit bass, a nice bass player, but a symphony man. And here is Charlie Horvath, sang inside the drums. Oh, now this, Charlie Edwards was either on vacation, no, that's, what the hell is this? That is Charlie Hamill. Now, They must have brought two, we must have had two violins then, and I didn't remember that. Because here's Charlie standing. Now there's Howie, the banjo player. There's Charlie Edwards. He didn't take a vacation that time, apparently. This is Jimmy Gargano, who was a nice hot trumpet player, not bad at all. And back here, who the heck is this? Can't make out. Well, anyhow, he was a substitute. I don't recognize.
When was this picture taken?
Well, but come to that. That's you're a year off from that.
Oh, that's 24 band or something?
Yeah, that's okay. That's the first recording band.
Oh.
When we made our first record, that personnel changed a hell of a lot there. Now, and there's Bill Rank. Bill Rank now has come
in.
He's the one that replaced.
On the far right, yes.
And by the way, he was Fort Wayne, too, a friend of Doc's there. And of course, Fort Wayne must have some good musicians because there's three of them there now in the band. But Bill, and I guess for the summer, that's right, for the summer they didn't use the two trombones. And we just.
So he was in the
actually,
band
we didn't play. I think we just used stock orchestrations, come to think of it, because these people weren't familiar with the caliber to play our fine arrangements. Yeah.
So he was in the band by the time of that prom date, Bill Rank.
Yeah.
April 4th. Okay.
And he remained with the band for the rest of the history of the band.
Yes.
And of the ones, well, that'll be sure. Discuss those. Doc, of course, remained for the whole entire history of the band.
Yes.
And the other pianist was a fellow from Cleveland who was damn good. I don't know how he came into the picture, but he was a hell of a nice guy. Good. And we worked out a lot of piano things, more than I did.